This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One of the big movies to come out this season is I, Tanya, which tells the story of the figure skater, Tanya Harding.
I told the FBI that Tanya was in on planning it, which she was. But the plan was to mail some letters.
Tanya didn't know about the assault, because it was never supposed to be an assault. Just letters.
If you're rusty on the details, Harding won a U.S. championship after becoming the first American woman to land a rare triple axel, a really difficult move. Her top competitor was a skater named Nancy Kerrigan, and the competition was not at all friendly. Kerrigan beat out Harding in 1992, and in January of 1994, in the run-up to the Winter Olympics, Harding's ex-husband was accused of conspiring to break Kerrigan's leg in an attack with a police baton. 2 weeks after the attack, but before Harding herself was directly implicated, New Yorker staff writer Susan Orlean went to Harding's hometown to report a story that was published as Figures in a Mall. Here's Susan reading from the piece.
On the morning of the meeting, January 25th, as on most mornings since all the bad news, members of the Tanya Harding fan club went to the Clackamas Town Center, the mall in Clackamas County, Oregon, where Tanya Harding skates, to watch her practice. The ice was empty, except for Tanya, who was bent over in the corner fixing a skate. She was wearing a stretchy black sleeveless cat suit over a stretchy gray tank leotard. Every contour of her body was outlined in black, her meaty back, her strong upper legs with their blocky muscles. She stood up and started down the length of the rink, her skates cutting feathery grooves in the ice. Her lips were pressed tight, and her chin was thrust forward. Her expression was wan and stubborn. Her ponytail fluttered out behind her. No other part of her seemed to move, but she was crossing the ice with tremendous speed. At the end of the rink, where 100 or so people were gathered, she turned sharply, bent her leg, and then spun until the ice beneath her skate began to make a sizzling sound. Suddenly, she stopped, skated toward the other end of the rink, spun again, pulled at the waist of her cat suit, then circled the ice once more. For an hour, she practiced pieces of her program, a spin, a leap, a movement of her leg or hand. The pieces were never fused together into something fluid or pretty. They were just explosions of motion between long, silent moments when Tanya would stand alone in the huge blank rink, kicking at a frosty patch or tightening her skates. She didn't look happy, but she also didn't look rattled or embarrassed or shy. At the end of the hour, when she stepped off the ice, the fan club members told each other that she seemed composed and steady.
Susan, you never got to interview Tanya, but where did things stand with the investigation when you first arrived?
When I first got to Oregon, there had already been the conversation between the FBI and Jeff Galluli, Tanya's ex-husband. It was already clear that in some way she was involved, whether it was directly or passively, since Jeff was talking to the FBI and basically admitting that he'd been involved.
Now, who else was a player in the story? There was a Sean.
There was a Sean Eric Eckhart, who is a self-described international espionage expert. And when I say self-described, I'd like to emphasize the self-described. There was never any evidence that he had any expertise. He worked nominally as Tanya's bodyguard. Sean was the most active party in this whole scheme to kneecap Nancy Kerrigan.
So when you arrived in Oregon, what was your plan? What were you looking for?
The thing that really bothered me is that Tanya was repeatedly described in the press as being from Portland. And I knew that she was from a Portland-adjacent area, but one that couldn't have been more different. Portland is a half hour's drive from here. It is an old, compact city that was settled by Yankee merchants who fashioned it after Boston. Portland is the largest city in Oregon, but it is of very little consequence to people like Tanya and Jeff and Sean, who live in and rarely leave Clackamas and East Multnomah counties. News reports that say Tanya is from Portland have missed the geographical and sociological point. The world that Clackamas County is part of starts somewhere in the Great Plains, skips over cities like Portland and Seattle, and then jumps up to Alaska, a world where people are plunked down on harsh or austere or overgrown landscapes and might depart from them at any moment, leaving behind only a few houses and some gear. The winter weather in this part of Oregon is gray and drizzly, and the light is flat and filtered through a low ceiling of clouds. Occasionally, the clouds bust up, and it will rain in spats. You can be driving around, and the rain will pour on your car, but not on the car behind you. The most monumental thing in Clackamas County is Mount Hood, a mostly dormant volcano which is 11,235 feet high and is snow-covered year-round. Mount Hood has several active, constantly creeping glaciers. Otherwise, the only ice regularly found in the county is the skating rink at the mall.
How much closer do you feel that you got to the story by reporting it there? What did you learn that maybe you didn't know going in and from all the constant coverage that was just going on television?
Well, the first reveal was the sense of grievance that I came across in so many of the people I met there. And they all had a powerful sense of being misunderstood, degraded, discounted, and that Tanya, to them, was a hero because not because of what she had done, but because they felt that this was another example of people of their ilk being overlooked by the more elite culture that dominated and certainly dominated figure skating.
Meaning you sensed a certain sense of resentment, the kind of thing that we've been hearing a lot about in the last couple of years.
Absolutely. It's a feeling that they're worth more than society gives them credit for. And in the case of Tanya, I think she embodied that. She was a really exceptional skater. And the conventional figure skating culture rejected her. They also didn't like the fact that she wasn't pretty and she wasn't feminine. She was boxy and bulky and muscular and had frizzy hair and wore inexpensive costumes, some of which she made herself. Nancy Kerrigan, even though she was from a working class family as well, looked a lot like Jackie Kennedy. She was thin, she was long boned and long muscled, dark haired, very pretty. Even though Nancy Kerrigan went from being a sort of princess hero to also then being portrayed as a whiny baby. And this is partly why I think we're so fascinated by the story even now, is these archetypes that were
Aren't they misogynistic archetypes? On the one hand, you've got Trailer Trash Girl. That was the implication for Tonya Harding. And for Kerrigan, it was, you know, whiny ice princess.
They're absurd, misogynistic. And really, what's amazing is they're based on the most trivial facts about these people. I had gone to a meeting of the Tonya Harding fan club while I was in Clackamas County. So this passage is from a conversation I had with the members of the club. "Trailer trash is what they call people out here," one woman said to me. She sat down and started tapping on the table with her fingernails. They were long and burgundy-colored, and each one had a different small image painted on it, a shooting star, a sun, a lightning bolt. She said, "There are plenty of people who think we're scum because we live out here on the east side. Well, I live in a very non-scum neighborhood. It's actually a so-called good neighborhood, but it's always going to be thought of as trash because it's east side." She tapped. Her fingernails clicked. Lightning bolt, star, sun. "I wouldn't say trash," another woman said. I would say, she paused. "Well, my heart just went out to Tonya when I first saw her skate. I just see that little gal out there, the abused child spanked by her mother with a hairbrush. And when they would do the up-close and personals for the Olympic skaters, they showed Tonya in her jeans at her little house fixing her car. And I could just feel her sink. When I started the club, the people I heard from were women with abusive husbands and Vietnam vets who had come home and felt displaced. And they'd see that little gal and feel really good about themselves. So it's funny that people would think of her as trash." "Scum," the nail woman snapped. "That's what they call us. It's a class difference. That's what all this mess is about Tonya. She's just a regular Clackamas County girl. In my opinion, she's a modern gal, what we would call a tomboy. She can hunt. She can fix a car. She calls herself the Charles Barkley of figure skating, and she's right. She's a stud."
Susan, you just saw the movie I, Tonya, which is coming out. Did it get it right? Did the film get it right?
The film is remarkable, and it was something that I went into very skeptically. I thought, I don't want to see a replay of this saga. And I thought it was absolutely on the nose and fascinating on top of that. As far as giving you a sense of the world that Tonya emerged from and the possible justification that these people had believing that it was their due to see that Tonya got the respect she deserved. It really is about pride and abuse and feeling frustrated, feeling you cannot get a break in the world.
So you sound like you had great sympathy for her in some way.
I don't think people should go around kneecapping their rivals. I would like to make that point just as a starter. You don't sympathize, but I think it's really useful to understand it.
Now, your piece ends with a visit to a church. The pastor was a young man who knew Sean Eckert, and when Sean bragged him about the attack, he went to the police, breaking the case wide open.
Well, this is, I suppose, a case for always doing more reporting than you think. Reverend Saunders had not been seen in weeks. I knew that he was a pastor at a church that met in a Holiday Inn, and they met very early in the morning. I was resisting going. Finally, my repertorial sense of duty overcame my resistance and laziness, and I woke up early and drove to the church, and lo and behold, it was the first public appearance he had made.
It's the first rule of reporting. Always show up.
In the newspaper box outside the Holiday Inn, the headlines were still all about Tanya. Inside, 19 people were gathered to worship, and a big bearded man holding a zebra-striped electric guitar began strumming and singing in a tender voice. The room was new and drab. The floor felt hollow. Outside, it was pouring. When he finished, Gene Saunders came to the front of the room. He is a handsome, fleshy young man with small, crowded features. He was wearing a dress shirt and suspenders and holding an open can of Mountain Dew. He said, "I know you've been wondering a lot of things. Some of you have known where I've been, but mostly you've known that I just needed to take a break from the publicity. We got calls from around the world. We got calls from Japan about this. I want to tell you folks a few things. First of all, you know that I am not Sean's pastor. I think some of you read something saying that he was with us, that I was his pastor, and you were thinking, hey, we don't know this guy. Well, we were classmates in school. I'm not his pastor." He chuckled. "I suppose he could use one now." People nodded and bumped each other with their elbows. "It's been tough for me because I've had to neglect you and the church business during all of this, and I've had to make choices. I shouldn't say this in front of our treasurer, but I was offered $50,000 to tell my story to a television show, and I turned it down." From the back of the room, someone said, "Reverend, we could sure have used that money." And everyone laughed. Gene said, "Well, I turned everything down. We'll just have to keep fundraising for ourselves. But, you know, that was real temptation." "Why'd they do it, Reverend?" He looked down, kicking lightly at the carpet. "Bitterness, I think. Bitterness that things weren't going their way." A ruddy-faced man flipped his study guide open to Luke 14. "All the answers are right here," he whispered to me. He ran a fingernail across the page to where it said, "Wanting a new car or hoping to be successful in your career is not wrong in itself. It is wrong only when you want these things just to impress others." He closed the book and then closed his eyes. Gene finished speaking and shook everyone's hand and said he would be back every Sunday unless things got too distracting again.
That was The New Yorker's Susan Orlean. Her story about Tanya Harding, Figures in a Mall, ran in the magazine in February of 1994. You can find it at newyorkerradio.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.